Hey everybody, I just want to give a quick note before getting into this episode that this is an episode where we talk about some really deep stuff, specifically around PTSD and the war. So I just want to go ahead, if you have anybody that might be triggered by that, or if you have any little ears and little kids around, this is not the episode for you to play out where others can hear, but this is an episode I do want you to hear because it has such powerful messaging, and Sean is such an amazing person to come out and to speak so openly about his ghost and that he's not sorry for talking about him. So, with that said, let's get into it.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Welcome to Unapologetically Bold, I'm Not Sorry For. If you are a person that is tired of apologizing for being you, you know, the human part of you that sometimes feels like it has to be different at home versus work versus play, the human side that just wants to be hot, humble, open, and transparent about your wants, desires, and uniqueness. If you answered yes, this is for you. Join me, Emily Elrod, as I dive into conversations with amazing guests about what they are not sorry for in creative and loving ways. Let's get started. Hey, everybody. We are live for another Unapologetically Bold, I'm Not Sorry For. And I'm blessed today to have Sean with me. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on.
So for the people that do not know who you are, Sean, just give them a little background.
Well, my name is Sean Ambrose. I've been in the military for 12 years now. As a military policeman, I have served two tours in Afghanistan. My first one was, I mean, both as a military policeman, but my first one was as a medic. I got kind of thrown into that role. And then my second was as a designated squad marksman, kind of got thrown into that role as well. And then now I'm currently serving at Fort Leonard, Missouri, where I teach the Military Police Senior Leaders Course as an instructor.
So we're just going to hop right on into this. Yeah. And the show's called Unapologetically Bold. So, Sean, what are you not sorry for?
I guess just who I am as a leader in the military, who I am as a person. I know that I have a lot of shortfalls and things that I could probably improve on. But for the most part, I mean, I kind of am who I am. And so, you know, as a leader, I probably don't make all the best decisions, but I always make sure that I have my soldiers and their families at the forefront of my mind in every decision that I make. So at the end of the day, I try to do the best I can.
I love that. And I think that's something that I embrace a lot is about, again, the human. You're a human at home, work, and play. But sometimes we feel like we have different priorities or we have different struggles between each one that we can't bring our full selves forward. So in your leadership, what have you learned about, in essence, like, not just talk, I know that you have the book about talking about your ghost and your past, but just talking about some of those things that sometimes it's like, oh, we don't mention that. We don't mention, yeah, as a leader.
I think leaders have a hard time taking care of leaders. I mean, we're great. Leaders are great at taking care of soldiers, but leaders suck at taking care of leaders. They think that they can balance it all and that they could take care of everything and that they're problem solvers and that they're invincible and, you know, that everything's going to be okay and they'll figure their stuff out later. But ultimately we're human and, you know, we do suck at things and, you know, we have our shortfalls. And so I think, the weaknesses of leaders, cause you never want to be deemed weak as a leader. I think that's something that needs to be talked about more. And the more open you are with it, the more your soldiers, I think, will really not just soldiers. I think any subordinate, no matter what, where in the workforce you are, will respect you more for it.
And that makes me think of finding, knowing your strengths, but also knowing your weaknesses, because in the aspect of mine, I always talk about consistency is something that I know that I can be weak at, especially if it doesn't have a person attached to it. So posting things on LinkedIn or being consistent with that or whatever it may be, like, I'll get to it. But I know it's some things that some people value. So, and I have to be consistent. So finding ways to compensate for or finding people that are good at it to help. So that makes me think of delegation. In the leadership side of it too, which I know this is going a little bit off of what we were talking about, but I think it's really interesting because one, I did not know that you taught leadership. So now we're going to a whole other level. sorry, y'all. But about the leadership, about delegation and ego and how those kind of play with each other. Because I found a lot of times that people, it's very hard for them to lay down their ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely. And so what have you seen? What it, in your experience?
You, to be a successful leader, like I said, you kind of have to expose your own weaknesses. I mean, I was very open with my soldiers, what I sucked at, what I was weak at. And I would actually use those moments as teaching tools for myself and the soldiers. So, you know, you got somebody like me who's been in the military for a decade, and I go to a soldier who may have more experience with, you know, say working law enforcement, and they've only been in 2 years. Ultimately, on paper, I should know more than them when it comes to that. But just it's the way my career panned out. And so I was not nervous or embarrassed to go to a soldier like, yo, man, I don't know what this is. Like, can you show me? And they were like, wow, my platoon sergeant, you know, feels like, or he's showing me that he's not like this big, scary guy who, you know, knows everything. And then it's a moment for them to teach me. And it feels like they're giving back and they're teaching somebody, and I'm teaching them at a young age how to be a young leader. So it kind of just goes around. It's a vicious circle that's is for the better.
Yeah, and I agree on that, because it's an interesting thing whenever how much you can learn. But I know for me at first, I am always blessed to be around some really amazing leaders that are twice my age. And I actually joked about this because I talked with he's a psych guy that helps, or mental skills guy that helps with one of the baseball teams, professional baseball teams. And I was just chit chatting with him, and we were just talking about things, and we learned from each other. And it doesn't matter how many degrees you have behind your name. It doesn't matter. You can always learn from people. But sometimes as a younger person, I felt like I wasn't to their level. So I love that you come to them and that reciprocation of it, of being a mentor mentee, and both everybody can learn from it. So how do you teach that in the work that you do?
So I teach a senior leaders course. So I'm dealing with a lot of staff sergeants who are about to be promoted to sergeant first class and become a platoon sergeant. And so they're currently squad leaders right now. They control anywhere between usually about 12 to 16 guys. And they're going to get ready to become a platoon sergeant, which runs anywhere between 35 to 45-ish soldiers underneath them. And so and it's the first time they get partnered up with a commissioned officer. So as a platoon sergeant, you have a lieutenant that you work with hand in hand. And so that's a whole other realm of things that they need to understand to learn. And so during this course, obviously we go over the institutional stuff, the regulational, doctrinal material that senior leaders need to know, but we also share experiences. And usually I have 16 students and then me as the instructor. So there's 17 of us in there. Usually people have been in the military. Usually I've seen anywhere between maybe 8 to 18 years in that classroom. And each one of them come from different walks of life and have been at different duty stations, different deployments, different parts of the world. And it's a two-month course that we could all come together, and I could take the 200-year plus experience that are floating within that room and share those experiences. And it's not just me being the instructor. Like, I just am more of a facilitator, mm-hmm. and I go over the things that we need to go over, and I use them as examples, and I say, hey, tell me about this. What did you learn? And then they get to share their experience. And it kind of just, like I said, it's a vicious circle. It works itself out. And it's not just me up there just being a talking head and telling mm-hmm. them my way, because my way may not always be the best.
If you ever get an email from me, it always says the kiss of death is to be the genius with 10,000 helpers, instead be the genius with 10,000 geniuses. And I hear that so loud and clear with what you're saying right now, and the importance of using that knowledge and in essence wisdom that has came from the other people. So I do want to shift back on to your book and some of the things that you've written about as well. Because we've been talking a lot, we've been doing 21 Days of Gratitude for Veteran Suicide Awareness, so mental health. Mm-hmm. And I know that your book was highly promoted in the aspect of speaking up about the reality that happens a lot of the times whenever you're overseas, or when the war, the ugliness of war that sometimes is not mentioned, you know, from the hero side. So if you could just talk about that for a minute, about one, that impact again on leadership, but also the impact on just humans, and what have you received from this so far, from just listening and
from the book, about or like feedback from people?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to a lot of veterans. The thing with the book is I wanted it to be very raw and short. I didn't want to, you know, I'm not General, you know, Miley. I'm not General Petraeus. I'm not trying to create some new leadership philosophy that no one's ever heard of before. I don't feel like I'm that intelligent to speak on those parts and have yet that experience. But, you know, what I know is what I know. And so I wanted to put my experiences on paper, and I wanted to link, you know, current military people, most of our military now, a lot of our combat veterans have been getting out of the military, or, you know, as time has gone on, the war has kind of died down, deployments are hard to come by. And so now it's like, almost like Vietnam all over again. And you have a military full of fresh young faces, people who hadn't been to war, and the guys who have been to war are, you know, higher up in rank and aren't interacting with soldiers anymore, or are out of the military. And I wanted this book to be that link, to continue to share that experience between, you know, us, the war dogs, and, you know, these future generation of soldiers that are going to be our future young leaders, you know, the next upcoming years, as well as the civilian sector, and linking, you know, the civilian community to the military community, because I almost feel like most of the civilian community, especially they don't have an interest in it, just don't pay attention and forget that we've fought the, you know, the country's longest war. And it's all, I've also received a lot of feedback from, like, say, Vietnam vets, Gulf War vets, people who have served the country and they didn't really know. I mean, that was their war. This is ours. And they get to see kind of, I mean, I grew up watching World War II, Korea, Vietnam videos. I studied those things. I loved watching movies and stuff. And this was a chance for those veterans to look at a glimpse of our war and what the differences was, and kind of create a little bit of a bond between generations.
That's awesome. And I think it's important too to be able to talk about the raw truths that happen with it. Because a lot of the times I think of some of my favorite things I love to watch, but it's very Hollywood-fied or very, it paints a pretty heroic picture. Yeah. But sometimes there's ugly in it. There's suck in it. There's probably a lot of suck in it. And that's the one thing that reading a lot of the comments and just hearing about it, that you talk about the real truth of it and you put the real, like, you don't like sugarcoat it. And so how has that even been more of a connector for people being real and being honest? Because sometimes I've found military people, they don't, because they feel like it's going outside the rank, or it's going against what they've been taught. Like, you don't make the Army look bad. But I don't think it, like, I know what you did not, like, it made it look so much better, but some people might think that. So how do you go about that?
I mean, especially me being active duty, I had to watch what I put in book. I mean, I'm still in the military, and people forget that we don't have freedom of speech. Like, I do not have freedom of speech. I gave my freedom of speech up the day I signed my contract. That there's a point to it. It's so you know exactly what you're fighting for. And so when I can't go out and protest, or I can't go out and say whatever I want about so and such person or in our government or whatever the case may be, however I may feel, it's those moments that my contract makes me realize what exactly it is I'm fighting for, so that all these other people can do that. And so when I'm writing a book like this, it's very hard for me to, I have to watch our mouth, what I say. I have to make sure at the same time I have to tell a story to the best detail that I can to recognize the individuals that I fought with, without giving away any type of operational security that will put our future soldiers at risk. Certain tactics, things that we do, you know, certain talking about certain equipment, things like that, because there's still soldiers that are in harm's way. And there's no reason that my book needs to, you know, cast the shadow over any of those guys who are still out there kicking indoors. So it was hard to balance all of that. And then obviously I had to go through a process to where my book had to go through an ethics review. It had to go through Central Command, who controls Iraq and Afghanistan, for authenticity. And then it had to get approved by the DOD as well, because I'm still active duty. And everything had to get approved for, like I said, the authenticity and the classification, and make sure it was all good. So it was a hell of a process, but it wasn't as bad as you'd think. It actually went by pretty quick. I think it was like 2 months or so. And, you know, with everything the DOD has to do, it was actually a pretty quick turnaround. So, but yeah, so I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that does. And it's interesting too. So I want, if you feel led to, speak about a story in that, whenever you realize that Or when was the time that you realized it's, I need to write this book, moreover? When was it like, I need to talk about?
Last November when I started. So for years I had a lot of superiors of mine very generously tell me I need to write this book. And for years I just denied it and I just took it as a compliment. And I was like, no, I'm not gonna, I appreciate the words, but I don't feel like exposing or being so vulnerable of having all my information be put out there. It didn't make me feel very comfortable. I talk about it a little bit in the book, but the reason why they wanted me to write the book was because I was kind of given a unique situation. Like I said, I'm an MP by nature. That is my job description. And as MPs, we're more of a combat support role. I mean, a lot of MPs have seen combat. I mean, quite a bit over the years. And our functions have just changed at each war that has gone on. We've kind of changed our capabilities. Before, in World War II, it was, you know, even George Washington, it was, we mounted the rear of the element and we just stayed away from the fighting and we made sure that the rear element was always protected. And then as the wars progressed, so did our functions. And then, you know, we're finding ourselves on the front lines. We're finding ourselves landing on the beaches of Normandy and D-Day in World War II, Vietnam. We're finding ourselves in the jungle, closer and closer to the front line, defending, you know, these major battles. And then Iraq and Afghanistan, there are no definitive front lines. It's, you're just patrolling the country in this non-contiguous battlefield, and the enemy's all around you. And the next thing you know, we're finding ourselves in direct action with the enemy, and our capabilities are almost, I don't want to say infantry, because we're definitely not infantry. The infantry are amazing at what they do, but we find ourselves in these frontline battles so much regularly in Iraq and Afghanistan that our capabilities have changed. And so, I say all that because, like I said, my first deployment, I got to Afghanistan. And because prior to my first deployment, they sent me through like an EMT course, they made me a medic. And I said, well, I'm not a medic. I didn't join to be a medic. I'm an MP. And they were like, yeah, we don't care. Here's an aid bag. And I was like, so I had to go work in the aid station and I'd go out on patrol as the medic, but I was still a MP by nature. And then same thing, my second deployment, our medic had to leave because he was having triplets. And obviously there's no reason for him to get killed and miss out on being a dad of three. So they sent him home. Rightfully so. And so I filled that role as a medic. And on top of it, they gave me an additional soldier as a spotter and they gave me a sniper rifle and they were like, go up in the mountains and like spot the enemy. Like, I'm an MP. Like, that's not, you know, so it was a very abnormal situation. There are other people who have had situations like that, but as an MP, you just normally don't see that. And then I fought in some pretty big battles. And I was awarded two Bronze Stars with Valor and a Purple Heart. And, because of those awards, like I said, I was very young when I received them and I didn't like the vulnerability. People were talking, the telephone game, people were like, oh, I heard this happen. I'm like, no, that's not true at all. People who weren't even there, you know? So it was very stressful back then to deal with the burden that those awards were on me. Mm-hmm. And so when it came time of people saying, hey, you should write a book, I was like, no, like I don't want any part of it. And then I got here to Fort Leonard Wood, and this is the first time I haven't had soldiers underneath me. As an instructor, I'm by myself, and for the first time I'm alone. And I've noticed that with PTSD, it evolves to your situation. So before, when I was with my soldiers, we were going to the field, we were doing rotations, I was staying busy. My PTSD really didn't have a chance to muster in my head. I was constantly, you know, waking up at 2:30 in the morning, going to bed at 6 or 7, waking back up. It was a go, go, go. But now here as an instructor, I live in Dixon, Missouri. I have 3 acres. My next neighbor is like 300 meters down the road. It's super quiet and I just have all this time to think. And so I got here in August of last year and August, September, October, I made it 3 months and I was like, okay, I'm going crazy because I have no one to talk to. I'm not busy at work. I'm getting off work at like 2 or 3. Like, I don't know what to do with myself. And so somebody had mentioned again, you should write a book. And I kind of took a second glance at it and I was like, well, maybe if I put my pain on paper, it'll help me with the healing process. And so I did that. I opened up Microsoft Word and I just splurged everything. Within 2 months, it was done, ready to go. So
I love that. Did it help in the healing process?
And some people, like, especially some family, my family, this, some of the stuff that was in the book was their first time hearing about it, but they had known I had gone through some things. They just really didn't know the details. And some people were like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, do you want to re-expose yourself to these things? And, you know, simple answer is that, like, they were like, because I had I rewatched. I had like a bunch of videos and pictures and of like dead bodies and firefights and, you know, nothing crazy as far as like unethical. You know, it was all just documented that I wanted to keep. But I had to rewatch and relook at some of these things to remember, you know, the sights, the smells, some of those things I just haven't thought about in some time. And people were like, are you sure you want to expose yourself? And, you know, I had to just kind of tell them, like, you know, you got to understand, I see these things every day in my head. I wake up every day thinking Afghanistan, no matter what. So it's not new to me, you know, but yeah, it definitely ripped the Band-Aid off, you know, pretty quick as soon as I started typing. But I mean, ultimately, I do think it helped. And you know, honestly, what helped me more with the book was not writing the book and get it on paper. It was the amount of feedback that I got from friends, family, and people I don't even know that supported me, because I was scared shitless of putting it out there. I did not want I remember like pressing the send button and letting it go, and it got out there. And once I knew that it was live for people to see, I was scared. And I've gotten nothing but positive feedback, and people were reaching out and taking the time out of their day to say just the littlest words, and it meant more to me than really anything. So,
and I think that's the important part of it too, is that what I've seen is in past, which mine's nowhere close. Mine is just, I was a single mother and my journey of being a single mom. And it's the feedback that you get from people of knowing that you have stresses, you have struggles, like you're a real human. Like these are things that people actually have dealt with, but they never talked about, because it's like, oh, can I say that? You know, it's that vulnerability. And I love Brene Brown's work on vulnerability. With, you can't have vulnerability without courage. And to step out to be able to say some of those hard things that a lot of people have lived through, but nobody has ever did anything about it. Nobody's ever said anything about it. So from that, that's one I do want to honor you and say thank you so much for your vulnerability, because I know it has impacted lives. Just because the stuff that I've seen, it has definitely impacted people. So thank you for that. And then also, obviously, thank you for your service. I want to talk back with what you talked about a little bit earlier about adaptability. Well, I heard adaptability in it, like how you were an MP and like you were everywhere, though.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Do you feel like you've always been adaptable, or do you feel like
no? I was a very sheltered kid. You know, I was a picky eater. My grandma gave me whatever I wanted. I didn't have a crazy childhood, and I didn't have anything crazy that, you know, that drove me to the military. I wasn't a troubled kid. I was just very sheltered and quiet. I was a little altar boy at a Catholic church. You know, I just played sports. That was about the craziest thing I did, was play football and stuff like that. So, I don't know.
But I think it's so true that a lot of people that I know that go into the military kind of
have no choice once you're in.
Yeah.
You have no choice. But the Army is really good at generating leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, at a young age, you know, you join 17, 18, 19 years old, and even the lowest private, the lowest soldier gets thrown tasks on a daily basis, and they need to just figure it out. And you know, when I made sergeant, I was in the military for 2.5 years. Since, I mean, you count boot camp in that as well. Like you figure 2 years really of being boots on ground, and I have sergeant stripes on my chest, and I'm thinking in my head, like, what do I know, honestly, at 2 years and just in life, to lead soldiers into combat? I'm almost doubting myself, but the Army doesn't allow you to do that. And they continuously throw difficult tasks and situations at you on a daily basis. Soldiers do that as well. They add stress into your life. And, but they allows me to be a very adaptable leader. Because as soon as I make sergeant, I gotta be a psychologist. I gotta be a fitness expert. I have to be, you know, all those things. A doctor. So all the soldier problems that arise or things that happen in the field, I need to be able to figure it out. And so, Army is really good at generating a very adaptable young leaders. Even if we don't really recognize it, or if it's not put on paper by a degree, mm-hmm. you take any of us out into the civilian sector, even if we're not good at those things, we'll figure it out. It's just what we do.
And I think that's cool too, because I think that's a thing that you're, what I hear is from your book is not a traditional, how do we deal with PTSD kind of style, but the adaptability to see, and you have a lot of emotional intelligence. I can just read that easily. But your ability to understand that you have emotions, somebody else may have something similar to it, you know, but to be able to be honest and open and to talk about it. So I am beyond grateful for you for, again, your service, your ability to put it on paper and to be vulnerable and open, the courage that comes with it. What would you tell people about the military or about war? Like, if you could tell them anything, like, what would you tell them?
I mean, can we break that down into a, like, what do you mean? Like, just, I mean, there's like, a lot to talk about war.
there is a lot to talk about. Cause it's like, I feel like there's a lot of misnomers that like, I don't even know about, like, and I don't know much about, but we just see, I have a lot of gratitude for you, but to put the reality back to it, that I know you see dark stuff. I know one of my close friends, Joey Jones, he is on Fox News every now and then. Actually, every now and then, he's there a good bit. But he had his legs blown off. Mm. And it's like how he comes after it, you know, and he has so much, he's so positive, and he's just, but there's dark stuff that happens with it as well. So
some people aren't as resilient. They're just, it's hard to overcome. I mean, especially when I was a medic, I had 116 casualties under my belt that I worked on. Of those 116, 21 died under my care. And you remember their faces. Sometimes those 21, you're the last face they're ever going to see, you know? And yeah, I mean, you do see a lot of dark stuff. You know, you talked about a little bit at the beginning, sometimes movies are very Hollywood, but sometimes Hollywood can't even get it right. As far as how gory and gruesome and just downright dirty people can be to other people. Mm-hmm. You know, I give this example in the book. When I was a medic, I'll just give you a small example. You know, we were a Role 2 aid station, which meant that most of the casualties came to us before we shipped them out to the major hospital in Bagram. And we were the Role 2 for the entire northeastern part of the country that was bordered with Pakistan. And we used to get a lot of civilian casualties that would come in, and we'd help them out every once in a while. There was a man that brought, I don't know, she was a toddler. She had been less than one, you know, years old. And she came in with burns on her legs, like a boiling water, kind of like, he said that boiling water dropped on her legs. You know, she's under it or whatever. And so we evaluated her. We gave her some pain medication for the burns. And then the doctor wanted to see her, I think like in a week or something like that, to reevaluate her. And so the guy left and he came back in a week and she had burns on her other leg now. And like, he's like, yeah, it happened again. And he's like, can you please help her or whatever? And then, you know, we're talking and we're evaluating. And in our aid station, we always had an interpreter with us because we dealt with a lot of local nationals. And the interpreter, a lot of the interpreters are pretty cool and they speak pretty good English. And they would tell us what people are really saying and stuff. Come to find out the guy was taking the child's medication just to get high on his own and wasn't doing. And so he was hoping that he could burn the child on purpose and get pain medicine for himself. And it's just like, you know, you see a lot of messed up things, or that's not even combat related. That's just a medical daily thing. So you just see like the worst in people. And so, yeah, it's hard to trust people and be resilient. When I came home, I didn't fucking trust anybody. Even Americans, I was like, everyone get away from me. Like, this is ridiculous. But it wears off after a while. And I realized I shouldn't treat people like that because there's still a lot of great people in this world. So, but yeah, it definitely takes a toll on your psyche.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I think that's important to talk about too, is that how it can harden you. It really can, because mentally for you to do the job, you have to get hardened at times. Yeah. So that you can survive through it, in essence. Yeah. And that's one thing that I love to talk about is fear. And fear, that you typically, people say it's fight or fly or freeze. There's actually more components to it. There's one that's called care and connect. And so whenever you're in zones like that, how you can connect with your people. So you kind of, you may not have the resiliency, but you have a bond and a brotherhood or sisterhood, yeah, or whatever that comes from that. How did that help you in the process as well?
I mean, I was lucky that both my deployments, the units I was in, I was in platoons that were very close to one another. I think maybe there might have been like one or two guys that, like, you know, we had roughs with, or we didn't like, whatever, but it didn't matter when the bullet started flying. Like, there's nothing that we wouldn't have done to take the bullet for one another. Like, it's just the way it is, you know. So we were really close, and you know, we just hated seeing each other get torn up or hurt, or yeah. You know, even with things back home, you know, it was that brotherhood that kind of kept us together. Guys would get Dear John letters they would get broken up with, and we would be there for one another. We had to embrace all of our personal problems that were happening back home, because although we're off fighting the war, you know, there's still a personal life that's going on. Like, our families, our wives, our girlfriends, they're carrying on back home with their normal life. And so we have to deal with all these things at the same time. And yeah, that brotherhood you talked about, definitely it helped the daily struggles, you know, getting through. So,
and I love that. And I think to wrap it up at the end right here, just, I love that you talk about basically being a whole person and about how you connect personal with professional. And that is one thing that my goal is with this podcast, is being unapologetically bold about who we are. We see dark things. We all have problems. And it's like, if you have somebody that says the world's all happy, I'm going to call you a liar, because there's always something. Like, I've never met somebody that doesn't have something jacked up. Like, we all have something, but coming to it and having ability to have an outlet, not to say exactly a counselor, but somebody to just be able to listen with empathy. And I think that's a big skill with leaders. So I want to, again, commend you for everything that you've done. And my final question for this is, people are apologizing for being themselves, for talking about their ghost, or talking about things that happened that are more maybe personal. What would you tell them?
You got to let them out. You got to let those ghosts out the closet. You have to share. I mean, that's the reason why my leaders, when they got back from Iraq and I was a fresh private, they were sharing, you know, their stories, their endeavors, their failures and successes of their war in Iraq. And I just applied that to Afghanistan, because, I mean, at the end of the day, war is war. You know, the battlefield will change, the terrain might change, the weather will change, the enemy itself might change, but war itself will not, the aspects of war. And so I had to apply that. And that goes with anything. I take just life lessons. It doesn't have to be combat related. Any life lessons, financial, family struggles, and I teach my soldiers. Because there's no reason for me to have all this knowledge and experience in my head and not share it. Because that's how we create better generations after us, is that constant sharing of information. We wouldn't be where we are as a country if we just withheld every piece of experience and knowledge and didn't share it with our brothers and sisters. So we have to make sure we do that for the next generation so they can learn from our endeavors.
I love that. And it makes me think of a past guest that came on, and the company works, they do it for 7 generations from now. And how we're living today for the next generation, but also the next and next, so that we can be the best that we can be, you know, not that war will ever end, but in a theory that we're, as long as we can be our best selves and fight to the next day. So thank you so much, Sean. If anybody wants to reach out to you, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, I always check my messages, even like my request box, because I always try to tell veterans to contact me if they need someone to talk to. But that goes for anybody, really. But they can find me on Facebook, Sean Tobias Ambries, S-E-A-N-T-O-B-I-A-S. And then last name's Ambries, A-M-B-R-I-Z. They could also find me on Instagram, which is, I'm kind of on a little bit more because I work with a lot of veteran companies and organizations. But my Instagram is chief_pinkmist. And then, yeah, I'm on LinkedIn and all that stuff. And then my book is also on Amazon, Nook, and Kindle. It's titled Ghosts of the Valley. And then we're almost done with an audiobook. So it's going to be double narrated. I have a guy that has a really, really good voice, and he's going to narrate the entire book. And as you actually read my book, there's a lot of italicized internal thoughts as things are happening in combat or whatever. I went and recorded all those. And so you actually hear my voice in the audiobook from his voice and then to me. So it's a little different.
I'm excited for that. I'm an audiobook girl. So y'all go check it out. check out his book if you like to read. If you like audiobook, just wait a little bit longer. But I know it's a blessing because you're open, you're honest, you have emotional intelligence, like you're real. Yeah. And we say you're a hot human who is humble, open, and transparent. So I am.
And I do want everyone to know that, so I'm not making anything off this book, right? I'm very open, transparent with this. My publisher essentially gives me $1 a book, a sale. And most of my proceeds, like 90% of my proceeds, are going to a foundation that was built for my lieutenant who was killed. It's the Tyler Parton Foundation. So he was a West Point graduate. It's that he dies in one of the battles that's explained in the book, chapter 5. I did not feel comfortable. And I told my publisher this, had this been any like a leadership book, sure, I'll do what I can to take money so I could support my family. But I didn't feel comfortable getting really any majority of the proceeds because there's no reason I should take credit for someone who died or really other people who are involved. That just wouldn't be right. So I just want people to know that it is going for a good cause every time they purchase a book.
Now people are just going to buy it and not even read it. I don't care. Like, I'm just going to go give you money.
So. No, I want them to read it because I want them to know LT's story. I want them to understand who he mm-hmm. was and the sacrifices that, he gave us all of his tomorrows. So we can learn his name.
So good. Thank you. You're awesome, Sean. I am blessed beyond measure. Continue your work because it makes a difference. And everybody that's listening or will listen later on the podcast, thank you for tuning in. Have an amazing and blessed day.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Unapologetically Bold, I'm Not Sorry For. If this touched you in any way, please like and subscribe and share with your friends as we continue the message of being unapologetically bold by being hot humans who are humble, open, and transparent. See you next time.